Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All week long, it's been stocks, stocks, and more stocks, interrupted only by the occasional discussion of interest rate cuts. So how's about we get back to some good old fundamentals, indicators that can really tell you a thing or two about the economy, concrete numbers like corporate profits? Well, just like everything else this week, they're kind of up and down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here, everybody, on this Friday. It is the 25th of January. The fourth quarter of the year 2007 is not going to go down as one of the brightest spots in the history of American capitalism. I think we can all agree on that. Set Wall Street financiers aside for a minute, though, and a second look can give you a different impression. Yesterday, after the bell, Microsoft splashed some pretty impressive numbers around. Profits at the software company almost doubled September through the end of the year. Today, Caterpillar reported an 11% rise in net earnings. All the more impressive if you remember Caterpillar makes construction equipment at a time when the housing market is stalled. We should say a good part of those profits did come from overseas. Back home, though, an icon of American industry is an object lesson in the trickle-down effects of a slowing economy. Harley-Davidson downshifted in its fourth quarter to the tune of a 26% drop in profits. This country's biggest motorcycle company couldn't swerve out of the way of some larger economic troubles. Daniel Carson has more.
Charlie St. Clair has been cruising on his Harley since 1969. He blames the dip in sales on the economy.
People's passion for motorcycles has not dropped 26%. It's just about money. People aren't buying a lot of stuff. They're spending it all on the basic necessities of life.
St. Clair organizes the annual Laconia Motorcycle Week in New Hampshire. He says visitors at international motorcycle shows are also tightening their belts.
People are still coming, but they're not spending money like they were. And actually, it's been the same thing at the big three motorcycle rallies, Sturgis, Daytona, and Laconia.
People are no longer taking $10,000 out of home equity lines for a shiny new Harley. Susan Carpenter, motorcycle columnist for the LA Times, says the motorcycle industry had a great run in the 80s and 90s, but it was bound to drop off. The problem is Harley-Davidson has relied on one iconic product.
The Japanese have a broad base of different motorcycle models to choose from, but Harley doesn't really have that because they're just cruiser, cruiser, cruiser.
As baby boomers age, their Harleys are gathering dust in the garage. Carpenter says the company needs to court future generations.
Gen X and Gen Y don't want the same bike that baby boomers have been buying. So I think that they need to really kind of hone in on that.
Carpenter thinks they can do that by rolling out an electric cruiser. Meanwhile, even if the company's sales in the U.S. are slipping, exports are up. During the same quarter, sales jumped nearly 46% in Canada because of the declining dollar. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
Here's some news you haven't heard in about 25 years. Union membership is up in this country. There's a report out today from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. It says workers holding union cards crept up ever so slightly as a percentage of the overall workforce last year. Not a whole bunch, from 12 to 12.1%, so nobody's calling it a trend just yet. Still, Marketplace's Steve Tripoli found some interesting things in the numbers behind the numbers.
John Schmidt, who co-authored the report, says its most significant finding is that private sector union membership grew.
That really bucks a very long-term trend where unionization rates have been declining very steadily from these data, and we know from other data that go back for at least 30 years. So a big turnaround for the labor movement.
Schmidt says the private sector has been the most resistant by far to unionizing, yet unions are more successfully holding on to private sector members as well as adding them. Labor expert John Russo is at Youngstown State University in Ohio. He says a changing workforce featuring successful organizing of healthcare workers is behind the numbers, and he says stresses on the entire workforce play a role.
With the decline in real wages and the increasing amounts of work in terms of benefits and having to pay for healthcare, I think this means that people really do need to have unions, and once again are realizing this.
Today's report says California added lots of union members. The Midwest lost a lot, in part because factory workers are now less unionized than the workforce as a whole. Manufacturing used to be the backbone of organized labor. Report co-author John Schmidt says research shows half of all non-management workers would like to join a union.
And I think with the economy looking a little bit difficult right now and given the kind of stresses and strains that a lot of American workers are feeling, I think there's at least a potential for some sort of a return or resurgence of the labor movement.
Schmidt and Russo aren't calling this a turning point yet. But after years of very steady declines in union membership, today's report was an attention grabber. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Oil rose $1.30 today to close at almost $91 a barrel, which will do nothing at all to tamp down rumors of consolidation in the aviation industry. We mentioned earlier this week airlines are still losing money as they spend $1 billion or more for gas every quarter. It's usually happier economic times that bring those waves of consolidation, but fears of a recession seem to be solidifying aviation merger talk this week. Marty Moylan covers the airline industry for Minnesota Public Radio. Marty, what gives?
It seems to be the airlines are worried about profits going south again, and they want more pricing power. They continue to say that there are too many seats chasing too many flyers, and if they can take some of those seats out of the mix, then hopefully they will be able to boost prices, especially as fuel is going north of $2 a gallon.
Now, you've been on an airplane in the past couple of months, right, Marty?
I think I have.
Too many seats?
Well, personally, Marty tries to fly cheap.
I guess my point is, I mean, what these guys are trying to do is reduce supply, right? Tate seeks out of circulation and then get themselves some pricing power. How is a merger going to help them do that?
Well, they would reduce their combined flying that they do. I've heard some analysts estimate that if Northwest and Delta were to merge, they would reduce their domestic capacity by about 15%. So fewer seats, and hopefully they could boost some fares on some routes.
Lay it out for me then how consumers might benefit, if at all, from an airline merger.
Well, it doesn't seem like consumers would benefit. Those people who have liked to get those low fares would find there'd be fewer of those fares.
None of these mergers would happen without union cooperation, but I bet if you went to the unions and asked, they would say, we have given back enough to the airlines. They're going to have to make it work without us. Do you think it's possible that they could get organized labor on board?
Well, the Northwest unions have basically said, we could cooperate. You're just going to have to do some, how do they put it, do some contract repair. In other words, give back to us what we have given up to you in past years. And one other big rub in a Delta-Northwest merger would be the fact that at Northwest, about 90% of the employees are in unions. At Delta, only the pilots are in unions. So you could have Delta employees going from non-union to union, or Northwest employees going from union to non-union.
If you had to pick a pair, if you had to pick Delta Northwest or Delta United, which one do you like for happening first?
A Northwest-Delta pairing would seem more likely. If you pair Delta with United, that would be by far the largest airline in the country. Northwest is a much smaller player, so if you pair Northwest with Delta, it would still be the biggest airline in the country, I believe, but it wouldn't be such a giant that the government would reject it.
Marty Moylan covers airlines for Minnesota Public Radio up in St. Paul, Minnesota. Marty, good to talk to you.
Nice talking with you.
Merger talk did give airline shares a little bump today, otherwise not so much to write home about. We'll have all the details and the long, long week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. House Republicans spent today communing amongst themselves. They gathered for a GOP retreat at a resort in West Virginia. When lawmakers get back to work next week, the first order of business will be that $150 billion stimulus package that was announced yesterday. Leaders of both parties in the House say they're on board. Neither one is totally happy with compromise, though. And despite all the bipartisan talk, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there are plenty of potential short circuits left.
President Bush today said while he understands the desire to amend the stimulus bill from both the right and the left, it would be a mistake to delay the narrowly crafted compromise. But while the House appears ready for a quick endorsement, senators aren't so accommodating. Montana Democrat Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate committee that deals with taxes, plans to introduce his own stimulus package.
I think this can be improved upon, so therefore I think there will be some changes. We can do a still better job than the House than the present agreement provides for.
Senate Democrats, like Baucus, are calling for more help for the unemployed, food stamp recipients, and poor families with high heating bills. Union lobbyists, such as Tor Cowan at the American Federation of Teachers, are backing those changes.
The Senate is very much an active partner in this negotiation, and they're going to be interested in doing a little more. I don't think they think that this package really represents the entirety of what we need to do.
Republicans oppose the extra spending. They think the stimulus package is short on permanent tax cuts and incentives for job creation. Majority Leader Harry Reid today said more negotiating on the Senate side looks unavoidable.
And we'll see what we do with all of our Senate rules, what changes are going to be made in this. And I hope we can continue this bipartisan spirit on this piece of legislation.
The Treasury Department says rebate checks could be mailed in May, but that depends on whether congressional action really is quick. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
President Bush made a cameo appearance at that GOP retreat out in West Virginia today. He said he's glad Democrats and Republicans have found a way to finally get along. But commentator Andrew Samwick says the price tag for all that collegiality is going to be too high.
Bipartisan consensus may not be all that it's cracked up to be. The $150 billion package has two main features. First, it provides rebates for low and middle-income households. Second, it offers incentives for businesses to encourage spending. There's been no discussion to repay the money through higher taxes in the near term. We should drop the euphemism of stimulus package and call this agreement by its proper name, deficit spending. It's ironic that the proposed cure for our economic woes is just a different strain of the same disease. Cheap credit and imprudent lending policies by some bad actors in recent years led to overconsumption and overinvestment in the real estate sector. The result was economic activity beyond the level more sensible policies would have yielded. But hindsight does not appear to be 20/20. If we acknowledge that bad loans fueled the mess, then why would we maintain the same level of activity through additional borrowing by the government? No good explanation comes to mind. Maybe we're simply addicted to borrowing. We've maxed out our credit lines in the private sector and with the rest of the world. We will now use the government to write ourselves a check for $150 billion to be spent on our own consumption today, but paid for by future generations. Why are we entitled to pass them this additional debt? When the economy slows, we should expect some cyclical widening of the deficit, even with no change in policy. An honest fiscal policy would be calibrated to balance the federal budget over a complete business cycle. If we have no intention of running an additional $150 billion surplus when the economy turns around, then we have no business pushing this deficit bill forward now, regardless of where we are in the electoral cycle.
Andrew Samwick is a professor of economics at Dartmouth College. In 2003 and 2004, he was the chief economist for the president's Council of Economic Advisors. If you've got plans for that rebate check, let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. How are you holding up, David?
Now much better because I just got a note. There is absolutely no chance they're going to resume trading again and put us through any more of this.
Yeah, I don't think you put your time in this week, pal. It was only 4 days.
You know, it was just terrible. And all these screwy things are happening. You know, but every day, and there's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, yeah. I stop and I thank my lucky stars that we have Sarbanes-Oxley.
Wow. You know? All right. That's a blast
because,
from the past. Go ahead.
Well, no, but, you know, those are the giants that kept us from all the financial scandals that we could have had. I mean, just think if all the big banks in the United States of America were being bamboozled or bamboozling us or,
so,
or
right,
if
so
there was some sort of financial scheme or, you know, and I think the French probably learned from us so that they could really scrutinize all of their business dealings.
Now
thank goodness we have Sarbanes and Oxley.
Now you're just being petty. Come on.
Oh, come on. I'm entitled to it after this week. I mean, this was a screwy week. You know, the market fell into a hole because of a boondoggle. I mean, this stuff out of France was just, I mean, there's going to be a good, maybe not a Dan Brown, but maybe one of those Charlie Wilson war movies that's made out of this thing. I mean, here's this little worm who's bamboozling the financial system, and then finally the French wake up on a Friday and discover they've been bamboozled, and then they just rubber hose him and everything all day Saturday to get the stuffing out of him. And they walk in on a day when the largest market in the world is closed and decide to dump all this stock, and don't tell anybody, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even on the QT, and make everybody thinks the world's coming to an end. Well, now, that's the kind of week we had.
Let me extrapolate here. What I hear you saying is you have some suspicions that the Federal Reserve saw this happening on Monday and Tuesday morning gave us a rate cut that they were sort of bamboozled into?
I think so. I mean, nobody told them what was going on. You look around, my goodness, you know, it's been a rotten market, and you're talking about meltdowns and rumors of financial institutions falling apart. And then you start seeing this world, you know, this global economic collapse coming. And you know what's going to happen when the U.S. starts trading, you know, the following day, if you've had that kind of background. So, yeah, I mean, I think they did probably the only thing they could. But now with hindsight, I'm telling you, if they'd known what was going on, they would have just waited till next week. I mean, right, they really didn't. With hindsight, I don't think they needed to cut.
All right. Well, hang on a second. In all seriousness, let's pay it forward here for a second. What does this mean now for Tuesday? Have they sort of locked themselves into doing something by their actions a week ago?
I think they're locked into a rate cut. And I don't think a quarter point's going to cut it. I think it'll probably be a half. And I think, you know, you combine that the get a check back scheme from the government and then some falling energy prices and everybody refinancing their mortgage. And all of a sudden, you know, in the fourth quarter, we're going to be talking about and wondering where all this inflation came from. It's an interesting scenario. Thank God we've got Sarbanes and Oxley.
David Johnson, at his cynical best down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend,
Kyle. You too. Coming up, a big record label struggles to keep its head above water.
How do you compete with free? You have a generation growing up that love music still. They just assume that it's just there.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stop me if you've heard this one before. Nagging credit market worries and nail-biting over the Fed's rate cut plan sank the Dow Industrials again today. The blue chips finished down 1.3%, 171 points at 12,207. The NASDAQ lost around 1.5%, 34 points to close at 2,326. The S&P 500 sagged 1.6%, 21 points, wrapped up at 1,334 the day and the week. If you're keeping score on the week by chance, things weren't as bad as they might seem for the Dow and the S&P anyway. They actually posted weekly gains for the first time in 5 weeks. The Dow tacked on 0.9%. The S&P 500 added 0.4% since Tuesday. But you can subtract 0.6% from the NASDAQ's tally for the week. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 3.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for December. President Bush is scheduled to deliver his final State of the Union address in the evening. And 30 years ago, dreams began to come true for vacationers welcomed to Fantasy Island. The television series premiered on January 28, 1978. Saturday nights were never quite the same. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizadal. Somehow the World Economic Forum just wouldn't be the same without Bono and Bill Gates. And as it happens, the two are on a panel today in Davos, Switzerland. They said leaders of the big Western economies aren't doing enough to help developing countries deal with things like AIDS and substandard education. Gates also announced his foundation is going to back small farmers in Africa and other parts of the developing world, $306 million to help them work their way out of poverty. Gretchen Wilson reports from Johannesburg.
Small-scale farmers in the town of Newcastle use picks to turn the soil for a new food garden. But this one is in a school playground. A lack of good farmland in this area means the schoolyard is now their best option to grow cabbages, carrots, and beets. Soil across sub-Saharan Africa has been farmed for generation upon generation, leaving it depleted of essential nutrients for healthy crops. But most farmers are too poor to afford fertilizer at market prices. The result? Most farmers in sub-Saharan Africa don't use it. Angolan farmers use less than a half a pound of fertilizer per acre. Ireland uses more than 1,000 times that amount. So without the nitrogen and phosphorus needed to make things grow, farming has become futile.
It is impossible to farm properly without fertilizer.
James Breen is a farming expert with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations.
The soil is like a bank. If you keep drawing from your bank account, eventually you get a phone call from your manager. And that phone has been ringing incessantly in Africa for the last 15, 20 years with the decline in soil fertility.
The Gates Foundation put $164 million towards fertilizers via the African Soil Health Program. Gates says helping rural farmers is the key to moving massive amounts of people out of poverty. The vast majority of the 1.1 billion people who survive on less than a dollar a day live in the world's rural areas, especially in Africa. Rajiv Shah is head of agricultural development for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
In fact, sub-Saharan Africa is the only continent, the only area where the actual number of people who suffer from chronic hunger has gone up and not down in the past 15 years, and today exceeds 200 million people.
When Gates made the announcement, he was flanked by World Bank President Robert Zoellick, and that's significant. For decades, Western donors, including the World Bank, have demanded that African countries put their faith in private markets and eliminate government-sponsored fertilizer subsidies. But in recent years, Malawi defied the World Bank and slashed fertilizer prices. Now it's exporting food. In October, the World Bank reviewed its own record and admitted that removing fertilizer subsidies in Africa had sent prices sky high. Small-scale farmers won't be the only beneficiaries of today's grant. Much of the organic, inorganic, and chemical fertilizer will be imported from major producers in the United States and other Western countries. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Back in the halcyon days of free and easy credit in the global economy, private equity deals were a dime a dozen. Right before the credit crunch took hold last summer, there was a buyout in the music business that is still playing out. A group called Terra Firma bought the troubled British recording giant EMI. It paid around $6.5 billion, most of it borrowed, and it did what private equity usually does, cut costs and cut jobs. 2,000 employees left a third of EMI's global workforce. Some of its biggest stars have joined the exodus, too. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It must have seemed a great buy at the time. A record company with superstars on board, Coldplay, Radiohead, and the elder statesman of pop. Man on the run. But 8 months on, Paul McCartney has quit, so has Radiohead, and other bands could soon be on the run, like Coldplay and the Rolling Stones. Has private equity picked the wrong product? Music critic Neil McCormick.
The product is human. It's music. It's ephemeral. It's creative. It's created by people who aren't easy to guide.
Tough talking by Terra Firma and deep cost-cutting triggered the artist's revolt. Pop group manager John Webster says the bands worry that the company will spend less money on them.
By that, we do not necessarily mean huge limousines and first-class flights and things like that. What we worry about is that artists are not going to be given the marketing push that they were expecting.
But some artists may have been expecting too much. EMI, it's claimed, had been spending $400,000 a year on what it called fruit and flowers, a euphemism for sex and drugs. Ben Fenton of the Financial Times says there was one really bizarre expense.
$20,000 a month for candles at an apartment that EMI owned in Los Angeles. Difficult to imagine spending $20,000 a month on candles, but, well, that's rock and roll, I suppose. Come on, hold my
hand. EMI also spent heavily on advances, breaking a world record, paying Robbie Williams $160 million. He reacted to the deal with all the decorum expected of a rock and roll superstar.
Well, I'm rich beyond my wildest dreams!
EMI can't say the same. Word has it that 1 million unsold copies of Williams' latest album have been shipped to China to make roads. EMI's fundamental problems, as manager John Webster, is the same for all record companies. The collapse in CD sales because of file sharing and piracy.
How do you compete with free? You have a generation growing up that love music still. They just assume that it's just there.
The real money, he says, is now in live music, in merchandising, in sponsorship, areas which the record companies don't control. A major economic shift is underway.
The record companies, who used to hold all the purse strings and therefore the power and were centre stage, are going to become peripheral, and that the artists and the managers are going to be the people at the centre of all these deals.
The purchase of EMI may look like a blunder, but analysts say Terra Firma will sell the recording company and hang on to its fabulous back catalogue, accumulated during the industry's heyday. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace. You say goodbye.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, the new target in the war on drugs is parents. The White House Drug Office is spending $14 million to warn parents about prescription drug use among teens. And it's bought a spot during the Super Bowl to get mom and dad thinking hard about what's in their medicine cabinet. Fade up on a down-and-out dealer talking straight to the camera.
Business is off, man. Sales are down. Seems like half my customers, they don't even need me anymore, you know? I mean, they're getting high for free.
The Partnership for a Drug-Free America says one out of every five kids has abused legal prescription drugs.
Next time something goes south with your kids, don't look at me, man. Ain't my problem. I didn't do it.
30 Seconds of Guilt goes for almost $3 million during the game a week from Sunday. And that is Marketplace on this Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow tumbled 171 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ dropped 34 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 gave back 21 points. That is 1.6% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, a scientist in Mexico pioneers a new way of farming.
It's probably the reinvention of irrigated agriculture.
What to do about global warming? Our series Plan B kicks off next week. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.